That was a portion of Anthem to Human Justice by alto saxophonist Logan Richardson from his album Blues People, which will be released in April on the Ropadope label. Logan Richardson is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Network. OSIRIS is a growing community of music and culture podcasts connecting music fans like you with conversation, commentary, and, of course, lots of music. Check out osirispod.com for more great podcasts, and visit our partners at relics.com for music news and other stuff. And if you want to support Burning Ambulance on Patreon, we're at patreon.com/burningambulance. I really hope you'll do so, I gotta be honest, because the phone call to record the interview for this episode was really expensive. Logan Richardson, he is originally from Kansas City, Missouri, and he's been around since the early 2000s, working with Ambrose Akinmusiri, Walter Smith III, Jason Moran, Gerald Clayton, and lots of other people. He's put out three albums of his own prior to Blues People. The most recent of those was Shift, which was recorded in 2013 with Pat Metheny on guitar, Jason Moran on piano, Harish Raghavan on bass, and Nasheed Waits on drums. And that came out on Blue Note in 2016, although it was released in Japan the year before. There's a very interesting story behind all of that, which we get into in our conversation. We also talk about Charlie Parker, Ornette Coleman, the state of the jazz industry at the moment, and a lot of other stuff. And the reason I mentioned the cost of doing this interview is that although Logan Richardson was in New York when I spoke to him, he lives in France, so calling him on his cell was an international call, and we talked for close to an hour and a half. So again, patreon.com/burningambulance. Every little bit helps. I'm going to play another piece of music now. This is a version of the Bruno Mars song Locked Out of Heaven from the Shift album. I didn't get to ask Logan what Pat Metheny thought of Bruno Mars, unfortunately. But anyway, check out the song, and after that you'll hear my interview with Logan Richardson. From Kansas City originally, so
yeah, from Kansas City, Missouri. Mm-hmm.
So I kind of figure you've got to be wrestling with the legacy of Charlie Parker even more than other alto players from other parts of the country. Was that something that you were thinking about when you were starting out?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting because for me, from my I don't know what's the word, I can't think of it, like my juxtaposed like position, like if I were to look at it, I would say, yeah, I would imagine anybody coming from this place, or I would think someone coming from Texas would have the weight of Ornette Coleman, you know, equally, or someone, you know, something to this effect. And yeah, for me, it's very much that way. You know, Bird is the reason that I play, you know, really. You know, I know sometimes this can be kind of a thing to say, or it's something to show a certain type of admiration and whatnot, but it's very true for me. First, I'd say that I certainly had an affinity for just a saxophone. I'm not really exactly sure where that came from, but from about the age of 11, I was bugging my mom for one, and around 13, they saw I was interested, but in the meantime, I tried to take piano. That kind of didn't work out, but I still, you know, I play piano, and I love it, and I ended up having to play flute, didn't want to do that, and as soon as I could switch to being playing sax when I went to high school my freshman year, and I just told them I played, even though I didn't, and got a school issued one, a fingering chart, and just went home and figured it out. You know, in that period of time when I went to the school, that's when I went and, you know, to the library, and they had like this kind of animated book. It was almost for probably like, you know, children from the age of 3 up, and it was about Charlie Parker, you know, Charlie Yardbird Parker. It was and I read in the story that he was from Kansas City and all this stuff, and I was like, man, what is this? I'd never heard of Charlie Parker really like directly like this from anyone, and I started investigating. I remember going to Best Buy at the time and getting my black, there used to be that black label collection where it wasn't like a really a liner note, it was just like the cardboard cover inside, and it was like really a bootleg kind of CD label, it felt like. And I remember they had what version of that would I actually find that? I don't think it was a Massey Hall or something like that, but it was coming from one of these other recordings, and it was of A Night in Tunisia. And I think it's a fairly classic break, and I just remember they played the melody. I was in it from the beginning, and then it came up to the break, the 4-bar break, before going back to the form to go through the solo. And Bird took this break for these 4 bars, and I remember, man, it's really no shit. I was just like, I want to play like that. And, you know, the interesting thing is that I don't know if that time I was ever referencing playing like that, meaning like sounding like Bird, but it was like to play like that, that is kind of hard to put into words. And yeah, man, I mean, it started from there. And then after this, just the way I came up, you know, I mean, because Jay McShann was still alive and hanging, and you know, I did a lot of learning and lessons down at this place called the Mutual Musicians Foundation, or the local 627, which was the first African-American union, I think, in the U.S. actually. It's a historic landmark there. And, you know, at the time, I mean, you had all these cats like Claude Phillip Williams, local greats, like my master, personally, his name was Ahmad Al-Adin, other guys by the name of great alto tenor player by the name of Eddie Saunders, like these old dudes that were like 65, 70, 60, and, you know, when they were 10, they met Bird when they were in elementary, so they have all these stories, it's like, it's really crazy, you know. It's not only that I come from that lineage, like I touch and learn from people who were the link in between in that place. Like, they raised me, actually. And I was, like, of the last generation to be able to get this, because by the time I started turning, like, you know, 22, 23, 24, many of them started getting sick and started passing away if they hadn't already passed away. Mm-hmm. I mean, this legacy of Charlie Parker lives deep inside of me, I feel like, because I'm from the land, you know. I drank the water, I ate the food, I've, you know, had the fortunate opportunity to be in the presence of and to get to learn from and had the tutelage of so many of these wonderful people who either were there in the beginning for Bird or they were there as a child when Bird was there. And at least the one that I have from the beginning of Bird is like Jay McShann. Mm-hmm. It's really deep, and I think it's one of these things that where blues people, honestly, for me, it's just like a chapter in my life and in as being an artist where I'm just trying to seek out these roots. Like, what did it mean that they invested in me? What is it that they saw? And who am I? And it's kind of like searching for this constant, like constantly searching in the mirror to actually really see yourself, not to see what you're supposed to see, but to really see you. And, you know, I don't know, frankly, not to really give a shit about how that can be perceived. I mean, obviously you want people to like it and feel like something that they can walk into, but at the same time, you know, the path is still one that is has to maintain its righteousness and purity on a certain level in terms of its honesty to yourself, you know. That's kind of feeding into at least that Charlie Parker legacy.
Uh-huh. Now, and obviously, you know, you mentioned Ornette, who's sort of the other huge alto sax figure. So, I mean, when and how did you encounter his music, and what did it do for you or not? You know, I mean, not everybody loves his stuff this day.
It's crazy. Like, I think Ornette for me was someone, like, I had kind of a grouping of people like this when I was younger. I came up and, you know, you hear these names, and you know, I've been very serious ever since I started. So I would go to the CD store and get the CD sometimes I put it on, and the thing is I would know that it was in there, but it was just like there were so many things that now I would be able to tell you, like maybe certain elements that it was that comment. I didn't I didn't quite get it, but I knew that it was the thing, and there were probably moments in it that I did kind of get, so it caught me to continue to keep listening. But for Ornette, I had kind of probably started listening when I was at least as early having his recordings and things like this, at least by the time I was 18. So it would have been about 4 years after I started playing. Because really, like some of my first recordings would have been like Bird, Giant Steps is one of my brother who wasn't even a musician. He was like, yeah, you know, this guy's supposed to be pretty good. I know he plays saxophones, boom, and Giant, oh shit, you know. And that one I actually connected with pretty directly, though. It was just like a fury, and like I didn't understand anything, but it's like I could jump in Bird. But when it came to like Ornette, Eric Dolphy, it was different. But the thing was is that I think the way I always connected, because I always heard Bird in it. And certainly like earlier Ornette, you can hear a lot of his direct relationship with Bird. Eric Dolphy, the same for me, but you know, Joe Henderson, the same. I hear it in you know, John Coltrane, the same. Any of my favorite, and then in the end, for me, I think the pool and the source being in my opinion, Art Tatum. I think that's studying Bird and really trying to understand it, not just the way he plays and transcribing this kind of understanding, but like saying, well, how could you go from being like a dude listening to all these other great saxophones, many of them very futuristic and things like this, Lucky Thompson, Eddie Lockjaw, Davis, I mean, they're like many bad, McComan, Hawkins, Lester Young, of course, yeah, bad dudes, you know, stylistically, somebody may not get with it, but they're, you know, playing the shit out of everything they're playing. But then this dude comes and he's just got all these other things. But then when you hear, like, you know, all these quotes, you're like, well, yeah, you know, he wanted to, you know, or somebody say, yeah, he wanted to almost emulate as close as he could, like being like Art Tatum on a saxophone. And when you imagine this, and you say, oh, wow, I guess if someone was attempting to kind of have these kind of, like, strides using all 88 and kind of this way of, like, ornamenting and enclosing and really weaving harmony and melody together, it would make a lot of sense. And then you say, okay, well, that's really the hybrid. It's like when one instrument actually is like being influenced by another, and just a translation of that language onto another instrument automatically creates another sonic independent voice, and it really does birth a very specific thing. And when I look at Ornette, I see the same thing. I think that like all the greats, he drew from the greats and that lineage, and found this path of almost quantifying everything that got put into an aspect of what he got from Bird, and just almost making it be pure emotion. Like, I know his you know, method and idea was to make it make everything sound like one, like this organic kind of force, like, you know, to be like a vocalist, basically, like the band is like one vocal. And you know, for me, it's this pure element of expression. I think that hit me around 23, 24 is when I was in New York, and I started really, I don't know, it was like one of those all of a sudden kind of things. It was like, yeah, I've been listening to Ornette, but then I put it on one day, and it was just like, I could hear it, and it was like, I could hear it for myself enough to be able to be like, okay, now I'm starting to understand what's going on a little bit. And it's funny to talk about Ornette, because I was just at breakfast with the guys in the band, and I was just saying, like, yeah, like two of the deepest experiences that I had was like going to see Ornette. You know, he did a double bill at Town Hall with Abby Lincoln before she passed away, and and himself, and she opened up for Ornette, and then he came on and did his band with, like, you know, double bass and double upright bass and drums and himself. And it was, I mean, it was just, man, it was like, I don't even know how to explain it. It was like, obviously, would have been, that was it, that, and then being in the Congo, because we're after, like, up in the north in the village, and, like, having, like, one tribe of Bantu drumming and dancing going on in one corner, and then the other corner, you have, like, you know, these Sydney people that are living within the tribes of the Bantu tribe, doing their tradition over there, like sitting in kind of a half circle on the ground, like clapping and singing like different like hymns and chants and whatnot. So it was like really crazy, and crazy is an understatement, but it really was inspiring on a level that that really challenged me to who I am, and I like to think of like the totality of kind of like the way that Ornette influenced me, the way Bird influenced me, John Coltrane, Freddie Hubbard. Like, I mean, you know, it's funny how things just keep going back and forth. You know, you hear this and you hear, like, man, when he's coming down and he's at this point, but that's like the altissimo range for me on the horn, but I don't care because I want to be able to play that shape. And the only way to play that shape means you have to work out this particular type of a facility on your instrument. And that's what you do. But then you look at, well, you know, well, Freddie Hubbard really was like a daffy, like kind of more of a saxophone language on trumpet more so than like trumpet language. That is, even the lines and everything he plays is coming more from that thing, but it's with all the trumpet things too. So it's like this hybrid and a new way to play it. And Shaw comes and he takes that into the future. Mm-hmm. And still, even where that really sits, in my opinion, with Shaw still, I mean, obviously, my homie Ambrose Agamusri is on that path, but still, I still think holding the torch, Woody Shaw, and I think in between those two, I feel like Wallace Roney, whom is still around, obviously, and definitely not diminished by any means, but just like, I feel like, for me, it's like when I'm thinking about trumpet and people that are really, really taking that, the true, like where it's coming from, like Dizzy, coming from Miles, coming from like this kind of thing, really, you know, Don Cherry, this thing. And that's what I like about Ambrose, because I feel like he encompasses not only like these other lineages and voices and kind of historic traditions on the instrument, but he encompasses some of the other ones that were kind of a part of like the masters of the 70s that overlooked in the timeline of history and still actually do in a way. You know, Sonny Murray just passed away a few months ago in Paris. I don't know if anybody cares. I don't think any of the main publications, I don't know if they carried much or did much about it, you know. Even like when I watched when Elvin Jones passed, it was crazy, because I just didn't feel like it was as much of a memorial to as what there should have been, considering the legacy.
So let me ask you about this. Was the Joe Chambers record your first studio date?
That was, technically, it, like for the jazz, like, yeah, for sure.
Now, you were pretty much the kid on that gig, right? Like, everybody else was older than you, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure, because it was, like, Dwayne Berno and Joe and oh, good Lord. Misha Saginov, I think, on piano. And,
yeah. And, I mean, Joe himself, he does a lot of shit. He plays piano, vibes, drums, like, what all, you know, that must have been quite a, like, a learning experience for you.
Oh man, yeah, and the amazing thing is that was actually kind of like a bit of a graduation kind of thing with Joe, because you know he was like when I got to the new school, he was like my first improv ensemble director, and that's how we met, like physically like that. But obviously, I was well aware of Joe Chambers from all the albums that I had, so I knew the master whose class I was in, and so it was great, you know. And Joe was always cool, always getting in your ass, you know. And then I wanted to take private lessons with him, but for composition. I mean, I would have done drum, but, you know, Joe, like, considered the piano and played chords and, like, talked about harmony and stuff. So that's what we would do a lot. And actually, we never did any duo kind of playing like that or anything like that. I just, you know, studied harmony with him, studied composition, whatever, you know. And then after this, it led to, I don't know, maybe it was a year after I wasn't studying with him or in a class or anything like that, and, you know, when I came around school or whatever, then he, you know, just pulled me to the side and asked me if, you know, I'd be into doing a recording with him. And I was like, you know, of course. So yeah, that was a really great moment for me to get an opportunity to play with Joe and you know, get to just be around him, but also to have, you know, gotten to learn from him in a classroom setting and playing setting, and you know, then get to actually get to create with him as much as I was capable of at the time.
Yeah. So then, okay, you did your first album in 2007, was it?
2006, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, there's a track on there called Free the Blues, and then there's one called Urban Folk Song, I noticed, which are kind of, those are almost kind of Ornette-ish titles. I mean, what were you thinking about when you were writing the music for that record? Like, what was your vision for your own music at that time?
Well, I think at that time, that was like where I was really discovering, I don't know, just at that point, who I was and where I was in terms of like my development as an artist, you know, being in New York. I'd been in New York at that point for maybe about 4 years. I was really excited to get an opportunity to get to, you know, put out an album as a leader. And so it was... a time where I was just basically collecting and writing for a little bit, but not, I wouldn't say like for an album, because I didn't think about albums like that, writing for an album. I just thought about writing some tunes I could include on the album, which I guess is kind of relative to the same thing, but I think the thinking and application process is a bit different. You know, at this time I was listening a lot to the Bob Benzley Pygmy. I have this album I got from somewhere, somebody gave it to me, and I just have been obsessed with it, which is like all this kind of tribal singing, some solo, some with a group, some, you know, it's just in different formats. And I think a lot of that went into urban folk song, even in the bass lines, a lot of the just this, it really, between that, playing with a lot of friends on like this kind of like what's known now to be whatever they call this, I don't know, I guess imagine it's like an offshoot that's come from like, say, M-based type of influence, and say any type of like progressive rock, like Tool or any other band like this that's done, like, where you could have considered Tool to be basically a jazz group, like they just use different timbres and whatever else, because like in terms of like the sophistication of the writing and composition, it's pretty insane, and the singing and all that is like, it's pretty nuts. Like, actually I like Tool quite a bit. I mean, I don't necessarily rock Tool all the time, but if you put it on, like, I'm definitely not going to say turn it off, you know. But point being that I think getting a chance to play in a lot of these, my friends' bands, playing this original music with this time signature, that time signature, you know, you just tap my ass, and then, you know, like anything, you keep working on it and get thrown into the fire, you know get a little better ideally, and some of it started to just seep into the way that I naturally was writing and hearing things. And so a mixture of that, listening to this traditional Central African tribal music, and still coming from where I came from, you know, swing tradition, and also blues and rock and roll heavily, and, you know, in Kansas City. This is just kind of an accumulation of, like, music that I put together to do the album. And in this time, that, once again, that was my 23, 24, 25, 26 period where music would have been getting written, when I would have been like finally hearing Ornette truly for the first time and being able to kind of get into this idea of wanting to, because that's the thing, I think more than anything what Ornette did for me, like everyone had their specific influences, some deeper than others, like deeper meaning you went deeper into their body of work maybe than others or whatever, but that, I don't know, that's whatever, I don't know. It was the book I wanted to sing. Ornette sings. It's vocal. It's like very vocal, very emotional. It's pure emotion. Everything else is almost second to the purpose of mating. And so I like this idea. And then it's like the way I cook, man. You know, it's like someone's going to give me a recipe, I'm always going to say, okay, how about this? Even if the recipe is amazing, it's, I always want to, I get to be curious if I'm making it every time too. I can't keep it the same, or if I keep it relatively the same, I'll keep it tight, but I always want to try a little something just to see if it does something a little different. And or you can leave it set if you find like a good combination. And it's the same kind of with, like, I think influence. It's putting everything together that you have to be able to create a dish, and then, you know, you sample that dish or create something, have other people sample it, and then you get an idea as to what direction for you is still something that tastes good versus for everyone else, what the kind of democratic and diplomatic and group decision really was. And I like to create something that seems to a totality of human beings. Like, it's the importance of, like, whether someone listens to this or they listen to that. I'm not sure if that's quite as important as whether they feel it or not. Mm-hmm. Because that's what people actually have to sit with more than anything, and see, and that's when they can figure out why they feel it. Then they can figure out, oh man, this reminds me of a Led Zeppelin. I'm not going to tell you where you can figure out how what I remind you of. Find it. That's all I want to do, is be able to actually create a door where you can walk in, and that's what we want to do with any of our music. So I think at that time I was thinking of kind of, like, you know, this idea. I wanted something that was honest, something that was vocal, but, you know, it was still, like, you know, I mean, just like now, it's still, I'm still kind of just in this point in my development where I'm still pushing for the same component. So yeah.
And right around the same time, or within a year or so of that, you were on Ambrose's debut album, and then you also worked on Walter Smith's album with a lot of the same people, because Ambrose was on it and Joe Sanders, the bassist, was on both of those records.
Right,
so,
for sure.
Talk to me a little bit about those two records together. Were you guys all sort of, you know, friends and partners, and, like, what, you know, how was that, like, a creative circle, I guess?
Oh yeah, I mean, well, I think it's just, like, I've known all of them for different periods of time and from different situations. Like, Walter and I initially met when we were 16 years old at a Jamie Abersaw camp, actually, in, I forget exactly what particular town in Illinois. It wasn't far from Chicago, but it wasn't exactly Chicago. Then we met again later at 18, because we're in the same class, the class of 98 in terms of high school. And, I mean, him coming out of Houston, HSPVA, and then I went to a performing arts high school in Kansas City. But that wasn't really the connection. It's just somehow I ended up getting in, and he got in this All Nation jazz band, and that when we were 18, and then that's the year that I met Kendrick Scott, because he was also in the band. That's the year I met Mark Kelly, who may not be known much for playing upright bass these days, but he's the electric bassist for the Roots.
Okay.
He took that show over a couple years ago, and they all went to school together. Also, LaRon Thomas, the trumpet player, vocalist, you know, now they're all from Houston. They were all in that same band, because everybody's in that same class. But then that's when I saw Walter again for the second time in high school. And then after that, we just started traveling. And he ended up, you know, going to Berkeley. Then I was at Berkeley for a little bit. And then I left and went to New York. And then I was in New York, and he graduated from Berkeley and basically moved to New York after that. When I moved to New York, then that's when I met Ambrose, and so that's when I was about 21, and that's when we first met. And I mean we've just all been friends for a long time now. And even at that period, you know, it's kind of like when we all met, we pretty much all clicked pretty fast, and pretty immediately. So it wasn't even really like something that we had to develop. It was like we were already in it, and certainly with Ambrose and I, it was definitely like that, for sure. And so yeah, I mean, doing the projects with them is, like, really amazing, because that's just the unit to do it with. I don't even know a better way to describe it. It's just kind of like, it feels like, you know, a version of a sextet. Like, you know, if I was going to get, like, a tenor saxophonist and a trumpet and try to go with, like, a kind of Art Blakey kind of, like, frontline kind of vibe, that would definitely be, like, my tenor player and my trumpet player, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For that particular, and don't get me wrong, it's not to say I don't have other options for other people that I would think would be great, whatever, but I'm just saying, us as a unit, that's a very particular thing. I mean, we should do more together, something more extensive too. I mean, I've talked to them about that. I mean, everybody's down, but, you know, obviously it's the difference between being into it and then finding the time to actually get the shit done. So But yeah, those are my homies too. I love them. I love them both very much. They're really great human beings, but their musicianship is amazing, and they're both prodigies too. So I mean, that's the other thing too, is that I think that for me, knowing how excellent somebody is at almost being 40 years old, and then knowing exactly how they were at 16 years old, and knowing still now with everything I've learned in the last, I don't know, 20 some years, what I knew then is exactly what I still know now, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. Without question. Like, yeah. When you were 16 and you saw this other 16-year-old and you knew that was a bad motherfucker, like, and you still know that that's a bad motherfucker, like, 22 years later, then it's pretty confirmed that you were right when you were 16, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. Let me ask you about this Nicola Conti record, Love and Revolution, because that was, when I looked at it, it seemed really interesting to me, because it's like a real international sort of a thing, because there were players on there who I recognized from Finland, from Sweden, you know, and then you look at the cover, and it seems like it would be really cheesy, but then there's some, like, heavy music right on there. There's, like, a Horace Tapscott tune, there's Mal Waldron music, there's Max Roach and Charles Lloyd tunes and all this stuff. So tell me about this record. What was the deal?
Well, you know, Nicola is he's an amazing producer and, like, in-studio producer as well as a DJ. And, you know, he's world-renowned. So it's like, people are pretty crazy for him and all the places that we've been together on the road and things like this. You know, I have to say that I always have felt being around him and getting to hang and just even in multiple different situations around the world, whatever. It's like, he's always, I have like immaculate taste and always pulling out some shit I've never heard. I feel like I know the period, but I can't call who it is. And it's always something like obscure enough to where I didn't know it. And it's really, really killing. And so mainly the point being is like when you're in the studio with him, it's like you always know the musicians, even if you don't know who's going to be there, if you don't know them personally, you know they're going to be cool because like he has a certain type of taste with the people that he chooses. And then, yeah, that particular album was great because you got a chance to meet, for me, my traveling. I first went on the road with Nasheed Waits and Equality back in 2007. And that's when I first started, you know, traveling a bit and did Italy, then went back a little bit later and then more Europe. So I got that. And then 2010, you know, for whatever reason, I just got an email from Nicola to ask me about, you know, come to Bari in Italy to record this project. And we did it. And then, funny enough, we actually didn't even really work together really physically outside of the studio until, like, I don't even know, maybe 2013. 14, something like this. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, actually, you know, many, many great things have been gained from our association together and collaboration together. And I've learned many things about how to like produce and curate from watching and paying attention to like the things he's doing, not only in the music but in his business as well. I wouldn't be able to even tell you enough about, like, not only the things I've observed, but the physical things I've been able to, that have manifested directly because of the fact that I was in that place at that time, I met that person, and that's how I was able to get some really great things on. It's something that still took work on my side, for sure. It wasn't like someone just snapped their fingers and made some shit happen. I don't know if that ever does, but certainly I was put into the situation where if I had a goal and some type of vision for something, or me or anyone else in it for that matter, you would be able to get it.
Yeah. Now, I also noticed you played on an album by Billy Hart, 68, where it was like you a really young band and then him, you know. And so, and that's another really interesting one, because it was like three Eric Dolphy tunes, two Sam Rivers tunes, Mal Waldron again, Ornette, Jackie Byard. Like, it seems like a pretty, you know, like a pretty avant-garde session for...
Yeah, I mean, that record was really awesome. I mean, it was like, it was interesting, like, my time in New York, because I always got to, they either had the people that I studied with, which was like a plethora of great artists and teachers and, you know, just many of them, people, so on and so forth. But then I also got these associations because I had friends that would be studying with X and Y, and then they would be telling them about me or some shit like this, and then they would be interested and say, oh, well, let me hear something, and then that would lead to like getting to meet people, and then I would almost get the same, if not even deeper, kind of a situation with some of these masters, because it would immediately lead to being able to do things. It's kind of like with Greg Tardy, it was the same way. I studied with him, but basically after like the first semester of studying with him, by the second semester, I was doing gigs in his band. He started like a quintet, and we started doing that, and he was already, because for him, I mean, he's like one of the biggest champs for me, because he was just like, back in 2003 or something like this, he was just like, man, he's like, you know, after this, like the third or fourth lesson, he's like, man, I don't really know him silly, because I mean, he's such a bad motherfucker, it doesn't make any sense. So he wasn't like saying that he couldn't teach me anything. That's not what he was saying. He wasn't like, oh, you have nothing left to learn. Not that vibe. It was like, he was just like, basically, if I had to put it in paraphrase, in my own words, he was basically just saying like, you're ready. I don't really have any more that I could do for you to prepare you to be ready, like at that point to be ready for. But then he was saying that I was ready to be able to be out here and handle the weight of the thing, and that he was sad that the opportunity was not there for me to be able to have a platform to be able to step into, to be able to get the attention that would garner some opportunities. And so basically is what he said. And so he wanted to use his platform as much as he could to be able to help me to achieve this. And he didn't know, he was like, I don't have much, you know, blah, 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 but anything I have, like, I'll just spend, you know. So, and this is a champ. I mean, it's like one of the baddest living tenor saxophonists right now that still just kind of goes under the radar, just because that's, you know, that's how this thing works. Like, I'll be on the radar, they'll be off the radar, and if I don't spend time in my interviews making sure that I lift up the masters, that not only I'm standing on their shoulders to be where I'm at right now, it's like also my duty to allow my shoulders to be there for them to stand on. Mm-hmm. And this, for me, is like the balance between the totality of everything. I know we're talking about Nicola, but yeah, Greg certainly was someone that opened up that particular type of thing for me and believed in me. Nicola the same way. And all these people, that's the one thing, is that they may have whatever interest they had in me, but the one thing is that I feel like they saw me. And I think that that's one thing that made our relationships be so uniquely incredible and I won't say profitable, but full of fruits, more or less. There was a lot to get, because nobody was looking for anything except to be able to do the thing that we were there to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And was that the same kind of thing, you know, just sort of recommendation from a friend or something? Like, how did you get involved in Jason Moran's Monk at Town Hall project?
You know, that's actually I guess a little easier almost, because what I just told you, when I first went out for the first time on a tour, you know, I was studying with Nasheed. But when I got with Nasheed, you know, I've been listening to him since I was 16, because I first heard him on Antonio Hart's Here I Stand album, the only album that Antonio that released on the Impulse label. Mm-hmm. And great album, though, actually. And I remember always being like, man, who's that drummer? I remember being something different and whatever. So anyway, found my sheet once I got to New York, started taking lessons with him, and then I started just going all straight drum. Because that was my whole thing when I got to New York. I wanted to get that thing. I wanted to be able to deal with these drums. Cause that was the thing that like really coming from Kansas City, the drummers leaned on the thing a certain way. And I had like good rhythm, I think, but like at least decent enough. I could, you know, keep it together by myself, but it was just like still some of that, I don't know, that East Coast thing. Just they put that thing on it, it's just another kind of thing. You need to test your independence and whatnot. And so I wanted to get inside of that. You know, good friend of mine, Tommy Crane, and I, who's a great drummer, we used to, that's what we did. We got to New York, we used to get together and play duo for hours and hours and hours everywhere at his house, at school, whatever. We just did it all the time. And that was actually something Bob Berg, when I got a chance to meet him shortly before moving to New York, that's what he told me. How we hooked up his rhythm too. So that's, I just took that straight Bob Berg's advice. I took it, and then the shit worked like a charm. And then I just continued it with Nasheed, getting my ass tapped, playing all the things you are, whatever we were doing for that day. And then that led to our relationship, where he's just like, man, we got to do something, you know, because all these masters for me, that's all the true masters, man. I never had to do nothing except just be myself and just be in there. And every time if there was an opportunity, it always extended. I never went to them and said, oh, I want to record an album with you. No, it was always like, it was very organic, all my relationships. So leading Jason, the first tour we went out, it was basically bandwagon. It was not She's Band Equality, but the first version of Equality was like the album. It was basically bandwagon with me under the direction of Not She. And we went on the road. I remember, like, this just when we got off the plane, like, we hadn't even played the first gig in Italy. We were waiting for the dude to come, and Jason was just like, yeah, he's like, I got this project going for a month, boom, boom, boom. You know, how would you like to be a part of it? You know, they're getting ready to do the thing at Duke University, and it was like a commission thing. So, yeah, been in that project ever since the inception. And that's really, I met Jason technically in Kansas City when he came with Greg Ozzie years before, but I mean, I really met him in that form. Playing with Not She, and then from that immediately went to working with Jason, and then from that, you know, I've been working with Jason ever since. I mean, working with him in his situation with the big bandwagon at least since 2009, so you know, or 2008 2009, so you know, going on 9-10 years, something like that. And then from that, you know, it's been great. You know, it's been great getting to know and get to see these guys play. It's like the best lesson you could ever possibly imagine, you know.
But right. so what is your relationship to Monk's music? Because, he mostly worked with tenor players, so it seemed like other than the piano, that was kind of the voice that he wanted to hear. So how, as an alto guy, do you relate to that stuff?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I feel like... it wasn't even until, well, after being inside of the Monk project with Jason that I actually started to even really, I've listened to Thelonious Monk, obviously, most of, like, the time I've been listening to jazz. I just, I'm not sure if I actually understood it, because, you know, it's like, you can give somebody fine wine, but if they don't even know what they're looking for, then they're not going to really know what it is. And I think Monk is someone that you don't necessarily have to understand fine wine to get, but I think for me, I was someone that had to really understand it. I had to understand it. It's just kind of like many other people. And so my relationship first was like getting to that, to where it would be something that I would naturally hear, just not something that I would be able to analyze and say, oh, that's cool that someone would do that. My particular relationship with Monk now is understanding that he is kind of like our George Orwell. He was a prophet who was able to see the future, and was directly putting the future out almost in its verbatim form. I mean, everything about Monk's music is hip-hop, funky, going all the way back in terms of the types of beats that he wanted to have Art Taylor play on Light Blue, for example, on the Les Liaisons Danger Hoop. The release they just put out of the making of that soundtrack that never made it as a soundtrack, but they have all those tunes, and you can hear them on there for that one track. They're making a Light Blue, like 10 minutes long or something. It's just like, no, give me boom, boom, chat, boom, boom, chat. Each time, this is like 1951 or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like really crazy. Like, so you can see it, and you already hear it in what he's playing. Just the way that he, so he's just the rhythm and the harmony and the accents, and what, for me, it's like I hear James Brown, I hear Michael Jackson, I hear all these things, I hear after. It's like, for me, he's like a pool of everything's possible, and then everything is like terribly specific. So if you have freedom, but yet you have to understand the grounds in which you're free in, so which means that there's still somewhat of a particular type of limit line in a way, but not limit in terms of the way that you can ascend, but in the understanding of what this platform is that you're dealing with. And it's deceptive as well. You'll come across it and think it's simple, but it's actually very much not simple. And to be able to execute proper ideas and interactions and knowing where things land and how they lean, the accents, I think as a compositional master, as a person that had to have understood the streets, because his music sounds like urban music to me. It sounds like pop music, mm-hmm. basically. That's what he means. I think he was like basically like easily historically one of the first pop musicians that was under the guise of a jazz pianist.
Yeah. So let me ask you about Shift. Because you recorded that record in 2013, I think, right? But it didn't come out until 2015. So were you signed to Blue Note in 2013, or did you make the album and then shop it, or what was the deal?
Well, what we did is that it was like, since, you know, the reason that it took me so long to put out an album between 2009 and 2015 officially, when it was released in Japan, and then 16 in the rest of the world, and then recorded in 13, it was basically like around, I was already in contact on some level or another with the A&R rep at Concord. Ever since I met him out in L.A. when I went out with Stephon Harris, because I used to sub quite a bit for Casey Benjamin and Blackout since 2005.
Okay.
Through about, I don't know, 2011 or something like that. And so I got to meet a lot of people that way. And after meeting this cat, then, you know, we exchanged. I just kind of stayed in contact, and eventually it led to Concord wants to sign some new artists. Okay. So hold on. It's just that Concord wasted a lot of time, like in my career, for sure, that whole thing. And so eventually I signed, Walter Smith signed, Matt Stevens signed, Gerald Clayton signed, a bunch. They signed like a group of people, and there was supposed to be some type of movement. That's where Next Collective came from, because instead of a sampler disc, and that was actually secretly my idea for the most part. So then that happened, and then either way, it was clear after the next couple of years where they didn't do shit with that album. If they can't do shit with that, then what are they doing? Then Concord got bought out by somebody, and everything's changed, and then you're just in limbo this whole time. And so, but basically at 2009, after I did Ethos, that was the same year that I did Town Hall with Jason. And then the next day I woke up at home, and I think I was in Jersey City again, I had an email from Pat Metheny. And, he was just saying how he was at the show, and it was one of the best shows he had seen in a long time, and he was really excited, and he really enjoyed, Jason and Ashid and everybody. And he was saying, I enjoyed my playing this and that, and, he'd been listening for a while, and, his brother Mike Matheny, told him about me since I was a teenager or whatever, and, just kind of like this kind of thing, and a little nice email. And so then, I was like, fuck is this? I was early in the morning. I was still like, I didn't know if it was a fan letter or some shit. I didn't know what the fuck was going on, from me to him or something. I didn't know. So anyway, once I figured out what it was, then I just responded. I was like, man, I'd really love to, do this album with you. I've been writing all this music, with for sure you, me, Nasheed, Jason. And because I really wanted to hear, everybody together. I really feel like that would really work as well. I said, but, I just want to see if you want to be on a couple of tracks, for the album, because, I just put this. So I was just assuming that's all I'd maybe be able to afford. And so then, he got back, and he was just like, well, ordinarily, I don't do sideband appearances. I haven't really, I haven't played on anybody's album. Last album I played on was, Michael Brecker's album as a sideman. And, but, he's like, man, I really like your music, and I really like the idea of being able to get you a play with, Jason and Ashid, and the only thing I ask is that, I wouldn't just be a special guest on the album, that I'd be on the whole album. And I was just like, okay. So this was, at this point, it was basically 2009, this band was together. And it then around 2011 in March, that's when I took my departure to Europe. And Mikhail, this whole time, I was already working, trying to get like a deal. Of course, nobody would believe me. That was the first part. Who was I? Nobody believed me, whatever. And I didn't have like a demo of the band, of course. How can I get the band together to do a demo? But I knew everybody was down. So it's like the business part had to be together to be able to pull everybody together, of course. And so I didn't know shit about business, of course. I was raised coming from some old school method. Get good enough, meet the right people, get some gigs, travel around, make a life, voila, there you go, jazz, So anyway, met the dude at Concord, everything signed for the whole purpose of putting out this album. Still seeing wasn't going to happen. Concord's wasting time. So at some point in 12, reach out to Pat, figure out like that free. Everybody ended up being free in this one moment. And so I told him, I was like, look, we got to lock this shit down. Like, and if free Pat, you can't even get him for like 2 years at a time. So it's like, we got to make this happen. And so we locked it down, and Concord was still fucking around the whole year. So then just ended up producing the album independently. And still was like tied into this contract, but didn't use their resources to be able to get it done. So therefore, the master was with us. So now it's like, well, yeah, when it comes time, if you want to pay, you know, to do it, then we already got the shit ready to go. But if not, then we got it ready to go and we're just free. So after I was free, then comes in the Komikaze contact. So I was in Japan before. I met the president of distribution for Universal Music Japan. And so, you know, I did some studying and figuring out some other things. And, you know, I was doing my own kind of research in terms of the business and how shit worked. And, you know, I understood, you know, distribution runs the shit. And in particular, Universal owns all these record labels, including Blue Note and Impulse and Verve and all this other shit. So I just didn't realize how much of an advantage was that I was going to Japan, because they didn't fuck around. You present an album, a master that you have unsigned with Pat Metheny and Jason Moran, they're like, yeah, we're fucking with this. So Japan, that shit was on. It's from Japan that I was able to force Don Wise to obviously be interested, because he had been trying to get Pat Metheny to record on Blue Note for the last 3 years, and Pat always said no. And then here he comes now getting a technically now signed, because I had a distribution deal, because I own my master and my publishing for everything. It's Universal Music. They got to come back and ask me if they can keep reproducing it, whatever I want to do with it. I can re-release it on another label and spin it out and have more fucking apps and vinyls and whatever is mine. So that's not even a problem. And then, so from this, this then forges the worldwide Blue Note deal once Don Wise eventually gets back after his X amount of time. Then from this, I did sign the Blue Note and this and that. You know, from the historic perspective, it's an amazing opportunity. I don't lift my nose up at it. You may not hear it in my voice because I'm kind of blasé about it, but it's just more disappointing because I feel like they extract their own historical legacy in terms of juice. They don't support Ambrose. They don't push him. They're not doing the right things. If he's on the cover of Downbeat, that's because Ambrose has pushed everything and put him on the cover of Downbeat, not Blue Note. I can say that. I know the engine. I know the engine even deeper than they know it. Because first off, they don't own their masters. They hopefully own their publishing. And that goes probably for anybody down the line, because they went the A&R route. I went to like their daddy.
Yeah.
So that's
what
I didn't realize. We went to Japan, because they all have to have Japan, because Japan's where they push units, because Japan market is crazy. The Japanese market is absolutely crazy. And Asian market in general. Like,
I remember when Blue Note dropped the ball on Aaron Parks like 10 years ago, you know?
Yeah,
signed him. He did a fantastic album. I wrote a story about him for Jazz Is. He was on the cover, and then they fucking dropped him. And I was like, what's wrong with you? This is a great record. This is a great guy. And boom, done.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. I just saw Aaron last night because I caught the last set of Ben Wendell's Village Vanguard run. And he's like, oh, man, I think we're going to be label mates, because apparently he's getting ready to put out an album on Woke With Oak in the fall. So that's great, because he's excited. I'm trying to tell you, they're doing some shit over there that, like, I'm telling you, I've been signed to technically two major labels, the two major labels in the United States, Concord and Blue Note. I've seen the insides as much as I could of Concord. That was a little bit more fucking puppy mill style. Blue Note the same way. It's just because they don't really, they only give a shit if already your shit is viral. They don't understand how to actually work as a record company to make your shit be viral and use the components and make you actually work yourself to be able to make everything have this proper synergy. They're just there. I don't know what they're doing, but it doesn't matter, because it's the more things that we can create, then the more rush that they can do. And Ropado is right now, if they keep moving the way they are, they are the 21st century version of Blue Note, because Blue Note's about to lose their crown.
No, I think definitely.
Too many artists,
I mean,
first going to Ropadope to do the thing. I mean, they have Christian Scott, they have Terrace Martin, they have Corey King, they have Snarky Puppy. They've got all these. I don't even know how many different. You know, it's crazy. Like, so it's pretty clear like what's going on. And when you do good business, that's what you get. You get artists that think about their thing, and they're gonna definitely go there and say, okay, well, wow, where have you been my whole life? You know.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about Blues People, because, I mean, it's not really a blues record. Like, there's blues buried in there, but there's a lot of other stuff going on, you know, like 80s Child is almost like a synthwave thing, you know, and then it leads right into that Country Boy interlude, and there's some stuff that's like dub, you know, and there's some harmonic funk stuff. So, I mean, it's a weird way of looking at it, but I feel like calling the album Blues People is almost like a Trojan horse. You know?
Right. Well, yeah, because that's the whole idea is, like, you want to, I mean, I tried everything to make sure that the actual physical art was not, like, so, you know, not me on the cover with a fucking cowboy hat and shit. I wanted to not be like that. And also, like, the meaning I put in, like, the colors and, like, the reason blues is, like, lowercase and it's blue versus people is, like, uppercase and purple. And then Richardson is blue versus Logan is purple. Like, all these things have, like, in the green, like, and then looking at what these colors actually mean in terms of colors' meanings. I wanted to code it that way, and then also with the art, if you open up the CD, do you have a physical copy yet? Have you gotten one or no?
Not yet, but I've seen, like, a bunch
okay,
of the stuff.
Okay, I'll make sure they get you one, for sure. Because then when you open it up and you see the art is a continuation of Shift, because how I see Blues People is the second chapter of Shift. Shift was the one where it was closing out this life of being a 16-year-old kid moving to New York, and then that was the part of New York I hadn't gotten a chance to close out. That's why I didn't put out an album. It's not because I couldn't put out an album. I could have gone to many independent labels, put together a band, already had a slew of fucking music, and just record an album. But then that was, I guarantee if I would have done this, we would not have Shift. Because Shift isn't about, see, people, they can look at it and see, oh, this power band is this kind of, man, that's not what it was, man. These, you know, I've been listening to Pat Metheny ever since I was 16 years old. I knew he was from Kansas City. He's like a hometown hero or stuff. So for other people, they may see that way. That's how I see it. And yeah, of course, like, yeah, he's fucking filthy famous and everybody knows. Yeah, I mean, but that's not why. It's fucking Pat Metheny. Like, are you serious? Like, you hear him? Like, I mean, it's a, of course, like, anybody would want to have this voice in their, I mean, so that's the reason, like, Jason, but the thing is, they didn't want to pay attention. And no one wants to pay attention first because I didn't go through those ranks to where anybody owned my shit. So the thing is, I'm actually glad, and this would have never happened then, which means that I wouldn't be in this situation now with the, not only what we're able to do in terms of opportunities, I feel, but like the knowledge of knowing what's going on. And so for me, Blues People is the second chapter. The artwork begins where the last one from Shift ended. And it's just taking us through the same visual kind of journey, showing where we're at now. And then you got the disc on the inside, and then it's nothing but just art on the inside. No book, no writing, nothing. For me, Blues People is, you know, I'm obsessed with, like, sci-fi movies. Like, I really like movies from the 80s quite a bit. I mean, before the 80s, too, you know. I like Blade Runner. I like Terminator. I like especially the first Terminator, especially the way it always exists to me as from seeing it as a kid. Sarah Connor, like just that whole character, just the sound, you know, Scarface, this synth sound whenever the shit was about to go down, like this extreme drama, like, I don't know how to explain it.
No, I get the way that. Yeah, I get what you're saying, because there's a lot of that coming back, that kind of retro synth sound. There's a lot of that around now, and I'm very, you know, I'm very into a lot of that stuff. It's like imaginary.
Yeah, it's crazy
movie
for me, because it was like when I started seeing this being like a thing, I'm like, well, I don't feel like I've heard this somewhere, and it's made, because it's like, this is just like my shit. It's just like, this is what it reminds me of childhood. And so, you know, growing up listening to like Prince and Hall and Oates and fucking, you know, Boy George and George Michael and just like anybody, like, I mean, that was coming, you know, Cyndi Lauper, like, I mean, whatever, like, it doesn't matter, like, you know, of course, you know, Michael Jackson and Whitney Houston and you know, Luther Vandross and like all that. I mean, you just hear so much music, TLC and SWV and Boyz II Men, and I mean, you can just go down the list, you know. It's all this influence, you know, riding the school bus, hearing the Hot 103 channel, and then just putting on like the whatever, the equivalent of whatever Drake was back in that time, you know, like all that, these hot 10 kind of songs, you know. And I think sometimes even if you don't really know the lyrics to the song, but the beat or the whatever, it gets in your body. So sometimes you even start producing some of these things, even if it doesn't sound like it, it feels like it. And that's really the vibe, I think. So Blue Tick was just kind of like a, you know, trying to give a perspective of now, obviously just like out of like my scope, and then just kind of like, this is like a backup of music that's been long waiting. Like, I could have put out an album like this definitely like four years ago. But like I'm saying, I had to put Shift out, and that's really where it was for me. And now with this, it's really, I like it because it feels like for the first time I'm actually able to not have to do anything that, like, I've never been someone that's worried about what other people think, or if I don't do this, or if I don't say this kind of thing, then they're not going to know I can do it, or this kind of shit. I don't give a shit. I mean, because I always just say, well, I was trained, you know, to be a war. I mean, I was trained by people that weren't fucking around. So it's just like, if they want to step on the bandstand at any time and dance, anybody, you can go. It doesn't matter if you're going to quote unquote win or not. But the intimidation factor, or the ability of knowing what you've trained yourself to be able to do, this isn't something that's, up for debate. Not when you spent thousands of hours and I don't even know how many days accumulated in your life doing a thing. Unless you weren't there the entire time you're doing it, you have to be aware of what you're aware of, what you're capable of, so that you can know what you're not capable of, most importantly. Mm-hmm. To be able to strengthen these things and not acknowledging who you are because of some type of fake humble perspective is not going to be generous for you nor anyone else around you, you know? And so I think you try to find a way to be able to tap into this kind of space. And, like, so for me, that's what this album exhibits. It's just like, you know, you can say, I do care, but, man, you know, I don't give a fuck either, because it's just like, at the same time, this, what it is for me, this is my expression. You know, I always kind of wanted to have a rock band, too, so this is, like, the closest thing I've ever had to this, and honestly, in terms of like pure expression, this is the closest way that I can get to expressing this idea of like voice. Like, the idea is not to be like playing running passages or playing bebop skills or this kind of thing. It's to sing like a vocalist would, like, mm-hmm. and to not break this thing and to believe in the power of the singular note. Because I'm fascinated. I'm like, man, how can Ella sing one note? How can Sarah Vaughan just sing this one? How can, you know, Erykah Badu? How can Jill Scott? I mean, you can just choose whatever you want. Like, how can Lauryn Hill, you know, and sing this one note, Whitney Houston? And you're just like, oh my God, like, what is this? And this, like, it's got to be possible to do. And Miles obviously did it. Train did it. Bird did it. I mean, everyone's got those notes, but I want to, like, somehow compound these notes, like, it just make everything like that note, like, can everything just be that note? So yeah, then if, yeah, sure, you can play whatever kind of acrobatic things you want to play, and that could be awesome too, but like, then it's all about the when and the how, not the if you can do it, it's the when and the how that's going to make that shit be meaningful. Otherwise, it's not going to mean shit. And that's why I like this music, because it forces you to have to come to it and find that space in a very personal and specific and understood way. So actually, in its own way, I find it to be highly sophisticated, because I think that it's one of those, it's like reggae music. If you step into that and you're trying to play like bebop, no matter if you're playing that G and they're playing the G, it ain't gonna be the same G they're playing.
Yeah.
By playing Cuban music or whatever. You gotta understand the culture and the things surrounding it to step into it, you know? So people can like it, they can not like it. But even those that want to talk shit about it, I always would say, if they did, you know, I don't have anything to blast back at them except to invite them to the band and see what they have to offer. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's the best way, you know,
yeah.
The most diplomatic way, at least.
Now, I guess my last question is, why do you choose to live in Europe, and how did you manage to accomplish it, like, logistically? Was it easy to get a residence permit and stuff like that? And do you think you'll ever return to the U.S., or do you feel like you've escaped and there's no reason to come back? Because, like, sort of from a, like, a James Baldwin kind of an angle of, like, fuck this, I don't need you people, I'm staying where I'm happy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that I think it's, I really do, you know, it's like one of those things where I think sometimes, like, unbeknownst to yourself, like, once you do change your position or your location, it creates like another type of perspective that you didn't expect or anticipate to come. And then I don't think I really understood that until I started coming back to the States, and I was in culture shock, like deeply. Like, and it's like a really strange feeling to come back to your own country and be shocked, like to have this thing like you just got off in a foreign land. And honestly, if I came back, you know, first couple years, I wasn't even going back to Kansas City that much. I was just going straight to New York, and then I would bounce right back out. So coming from anywhere in Europe or any other part of the world, you hit New York, you're not going to feel that like that. You're actually going to feel right at home, basically. I mean, a little bit if you're not from here, but if you are, I'm not like that. But when I would take a flight and go straight back to the Midwest or some shit like this, now we're talking about a completely different thing. Especially depending on where I would go, because it was just like, man, I don't know. I mean, it's not getting into like, oh, this was bad or people are like this and that. I don't know. It's a feeling. It's the way it looks to the filter of the place. Not the look, but I don't explain it like that. It's a filter. It's not a. And the way you breathe I mean, obviously being African American, you know, it's like, yeah, being of whatever kind of mixed racial kind of conglomerate, I'm not even sure that really takes effect, especially in this country. If you just have a couple drops of black blood and that means you're black, all the rest of your ethnicity has been ignored. So I would have even imagined on a logical level more people would have been mad about that than just some, because that means that, well, shit, you know, if my grandfathers are white on whatever level and I can have somebody that's a this or that, then they're not counted in my equation somehow, because it doesn't even make sense. It's unfortunate, but I mean, these are the things that I also hope that, like, even with this album, we can blast out some of these things, some of this kind of like social injustice and just like kind of ignorance that seems to be prevalent in how people like to perceive people or situations or things or whatever. So, but yeah, I mean, being in Europe has been like a thing. Well, I certainly wouldn't say like fuck everyone back here, but I have to say that this is a really crazy ass country. And many of the things that go on really make absolutely no sense, and it looks very stupid and idiotic, for sure. I mean, I can completely understand why. If you're not from here, these are the only things you see. It's just like the same thing. Imagine what we see about Syria, or we see about Egypt, or anything else like this. That's the same way they see the United States. Like, motherfucker ain't never left. All they see on TV is that there's bombs, you crying, you ain't got a home, you migrate, and they kicked you out. What are you gonna think about a Syrian person, immigrant? Like, of course, that's their title too, and that's all you've ever seen. If you see a Syrian fucking biochemist, you're not even gonna know what to do. Or what are you going to say? Oh, they must be the exception. Why would that not be the majority? If the majority doesn't only exist in what's shown in the mainstream media. That's just like what they want to control us to think it is. So for their benefits, which we can't, I mean, that can be of any reasons, that, you know, it could be just for game and for hunt. I mean, who fucking knows? I mean, it doesn't even really matter, especially if we know that that's what's going on. And I think, once again, I say this to say, because everywhere, even in Europe and all these other places, everyone's got their problems. All I'm just saying is that over there, humanity is one of those things where motherfuckers don't really still seem to be infringing on that as much for most of the ethnicities. Yes, for sure, in France, everyone's French except those motherfuckers from Northern Africa. If you're Algerian or anything like this, forget about it. They are the Negro equivalent in that society. Not black people, not black African people. They're normal. No one's gonna look at somebody, if you black, is gonna look at me, I'm just like some mixed French dude or whatever, but I'm just French. Like, that's what they would assume. So you don't get treated. But if it's clear that you're from Algeria, they're the ones that are the thugs that are aggressive, that are boom, boom, boom. So everybody's got it. And even the French, and they're the ones that don't see color. They don't see anything. You're just French. In fact, they get fucking offended if you even point out ethnicity or this type of thing. Like, oh yeah, I know you're French, but I've been spent some time in the south of Italy, and you really have this. Oh yeah, well my grandmother's from there, but my parents are from Paris, and I'm French. I was born here, and blah blah blah. So it's like that's basically, everyone fights their thing. So everyone's got their shit, is what I'm saying. But I think you have to find your climate as to like what you can deal with better than what you can can't, that is. And for me, I find that I breathe better as an artist. I can move around more freely. I can get in so many different economic pools, all within like a very short reach. In fact, since I moved, many of the opportunities that came, like, imagine everything that's gone on. Even like, you know, we did this Tiny Desk concert a few days ago, and it's like, as I knew that it's like a great opportunity, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not like silly or trying to act like I don't know what it is, but still, for me, it's kind of like the thing with Pat and Jason. And man, maybe the gullible nature is actually kind of what keeps me good. Like, I'm totally clear on what it can mean for people, but I'm still amazed sometimes, because like, I still just see it as a really, really awesome platform for the band to be able to be on. And it was a dream, secretly, to kind of be like playing at the Vanguard. Those are the only two ones that I had. It was like, I wanted to be on Tiny Desk, or in the order of Village Vanguard, Tiny Desk, but no order, really. It was just like, these are the two that I'm dreaming about. Like, no other festival, no other. I've done many of these fucking, I've done North Seattle, I don't know how many times. I've played Bim House in Amsterdam. I've done, you know, the Blue Note in Tokyo. I've done Cotton Club. I've done Billboard Live in Tokyo and Osaka. I've done the Blue Note in Beijing. I'm saying, yeah, there's so many I haven't done too, for sure. I mean, I can't go down the list of those because I don't know them and shit, but I've gone to many. And I'm saying that, like, for me, like, I would know if I'm dreaming about all this shit. There's only, like, one place this dream exists. Point being, going back, all these opportunities, shit, Universal Music, boom, 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 all this shit, and even the opportunity of playing at the Vanguard, all these places that have opened up since I left. When I was in New York, man, I was just like another one of the struggling musicians, just fighting to have your thing together. I moved to Europe, and I still just made a point to be able to kind of keep, you know, coming back to New York as much as I could, at least one time a year. Now it's like, it'd be like two or three or four times a year. And I just tried to keep a presence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just seems like more and more things started opening up, because it seemed like moving to, like, how do you trump, everything is about how do you trump Kansas City, or you move to either Chicago or just another major city. But if you move to New York, you're definitely going to get them. So you go to New York, and New York will be the trump for anything in the United States. So then you say, well, shit, how do you trump New York? And by trumping just means make them look at you, not Trump in reference to Trump, of course.
Right,
but, you know,
right.
Trump, what did Trump ever mean? You know what I mean? I don't know. Like, not step on. I guess that's all I'm going to say. When you want to make a territory look to you, like, people didn't start looking for me in New York until I wasn't there anymore. So I had a certain little community be like, oh, man, your voice, oh, man, we really miss you. Man. It's not even just like you just call somebody to find somebody, you know, playing the melodies the way you do it, uh-huh. So you had that kind of thing. So you had certain people kind of miss you. So you come back and you still be able to do some gigs or whatever else. Then you had this other element to where, it's like almost like the illusion and maybe the actuality on some level from what people started seeing from the pond. Because if you start seeing, okay, even if I only have like 10 gigs now, but if I'm going from Germany to Sweden to Finland to Estonia to boom, 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 if you're sitting in New York, and yes, and maybe you've done a couple of tours or whatever, but you're still looking at that's how I'm moving around. And you know I live in Paris, but you've never even seen me play a local gig in Paris. I'm always just traveling around. That's the way I change the local scene. I said, I'm not going to move here and like jump off the local scene. I've done that in every other city I lived in. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, how about I just turn Europe into my local scene? And so I was just like, well, yeah, I'd rather just live where I am. Plus, I keep my dollar up and my market up. So I can keep my hard ticket value up, because they don't have the access, even though they do have access, but they only get the access if they're willing to pay the money. So then, you know, in the place I'm in, then they rarely see me, even if I live there. Basically, I don't have to deal with their bullshit when it comes time to play the major festival there, because they know that I have kept my exclusivity. Even though I'm touchable, I'm not available or something like that. It's like a game, basically, but it works. And I find that the kind of projection that existed on this side, it translated. Like, because it turned into this, that was my method, but then it just ended up that I was like kind of moving around and be able to work like this. I mean, but it's still not without force and saying no to shit and not knowing where the money's going to come from and shit like that. I mean, that's the part I don't talk about. for sure. You got many, many kind of droughted times like this in the midst. And, man, you know, it's like I just haven't stopped, man. You know, that was one of the biggest components I find with, like, many great artists, man. It's like, it wasn't that they weren't as bad as a motherfucker, like, and the woman, if you want to look at it, like, on that level. But it's just still, like, we still have this, it's like, that's why a lot of sad motherfuckers make it. It's because, yeah, they're not the greatest, boom, boom. But see, the thing is, they got that opportunity because they didn't stop. And then since they didn't stop, they that one day, that proverbial one day, there it happened. And then, boom, they get it. They met the right person. That person likes it. They're not a musician, whatever. They don't even give a shit. It sounds good. Looks good. They can make it work. They know their friends going to book it for sure because they love them, boom, boom. It's, you know, that kind of shit. That's how it goes. And yeah. People sit back and can have their, like, pessimistic conversations about this person ain't bad, this person ain't bad. Well, that's fine. I'd rather look at what they did, actually. Like, even if I can't stand the shit, because that's going to be the thing that's going to be able to actually turn everything out, you know. I don't know. I mean, I don't really know, though. I mean, I'm just trying to figure it out for myself.
Okay, that was my interview with Logan Richardson, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network. Check out osirispod.com to see the rest of their family of podcasts, and visit relics.com for music news and more. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.